Hello and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Not quite the bonanza of breaking news we had last week, but still plenty to sink our teeth into later in the podcast. Hannah O'Connor will be with me to discuss Ireland's win against Wales in the Women's Six Nations last week. For now, Bernard Jackman and Johnny Murphy are here for a breakdown of the week's news and games and talking points. Bernard, you were out on the road last week down in Castle Island. Where are you this week?
Yeah.
On your travels again?
I was in Castle Island, Listowel and Gortha Clay. They're the K4, the K4 of the D4 for March in Ireland for the rugby schools. But yeah, I'm back doing normal stuff now. No cattle. Enough fields are full and it's raining, so don't want any more cattle. But very much less fancy than our pal here, Johnny, over buying racehorses, as I said. But yeah, he probably spent a lot more money than I did as well.
I don't know about that now.
Actually, Neil, it was amazing. So I had been down to Kerry to March for a couple of years, but the amount of people down there who are active rugby fans now and Munster fans and Irish fans, it was unbelievable. Like, they'd all been glued to La Rochelle, Bordeaux. You know, there was a lot of them are going up to the game on Saturday night against the Bulls. And yeah, I couldn't believe it. Like, previously all they would wanted to know about was cattle and Kerry football, you know. But Munster rugby and Irish rugby has really infiltrated down there, which is great.
Well, yeah, even I remember last summer I was at Munster under 19s against Leinster under 19s, and there were two lads playing for the Munster under 19s that day. The names are gone for me now, just because I'm not prepared. But from the school they were, or the club they were listed, is it Ivera Eagles or something?
Ivera Eagles, Conan. Yeah, he's in the
From down in like Carrasavine, way down in South Kerry.
Yeah, I know them. We used to go on holidays in Derrynane, and we'd know that family. Conor Horn, who Bernard would know very well, would be very friendly with Con's dad. They had to drive to kind of nearly an hour and a half, 2 hours to all kind of, because it's right on the edge of the Iver Peninsula. Derrynane, so they had to drive, you know, over an hour and a half to training. Con then moved across to Cork to finish his year, and he was on the Irish under 18 schools clubs that I coached last year at the start of the season. So yeah, they really kind of broadened their horizons. But you know, it's the volunteerism in those areas is off the charts, because you know the logistics associated to getting your son or daughter to matches is, you know, it's nearly a trip up the north for anyone in Dublin. You know how far they have to travel, which is incredible.
Yeah, and I know that Ian Costello was talking to us a good few months ago about the work they're trying to do to get fellas like those two fellas based way out in South Kerry to kind of make it a bit easier on them to get to the interprovincial trainings and things like that. And, you know, trying to work out getting them to school in Cork and stuff like that, just to make everything easier. But it is great to see that there's a bit of a growing spread around the country a bit more. And speaking of the club stuff, obviously it's finals week in the All-Ireland League, promotion relegation playoffs up and down the country on Saturday, and then the Division 1 finals on Sunday, Clontarf against Corcon. Johnny Holland's gone into hiding the last couple of weeks, in case anyone's wondering. He's keeping his powder dry.
He doesn't want to give Clontarf any ammunition.
Yeah.
Posters on the walls.
That's 4 o'clock in the Aviva on Sunday. Before that, then, at 1:30 is UL Bows against Railway Union in a repeat of the Women's Division 1 final. But, Johnny, like, double header for £12, kids go for €4. There's not much wrong with that on Sunday, is there?
No, and Sunday's due to be a decent enough day. So, I think probably, Conn will like to play a bit more probably than Tarf. Tarf are very much getting an arm wrestle, and, you know, they have a very big scrum, big maul, good kicking game. So, yeah, it'll be kind of two styles going at each other. And, you know, to be fair, Tarf have been up near the top with two powerhouses of AIL, and, you know, the women's game as well. Again, repeat, as you said, from last year, like, it's great, and it's a fabulous day out. I've always been trying to get them to try and do a finals day where they would have maybe our finals weekend in the Aviva, where all, you know, you start with 2C and work your whole way up over a full kind of bumper weekend, but logistics just, and then for the promotion relegation stuff, very hard to give up that kind of home you know, that home final to agree to it. But yeah, so but yeah, it's a great weekend. And if you're watching the live stream, fair play to the IRFU for putting on the live streams. I'd say they were wildly watched across the island. And it was a good spectacle considering the amount of rain and the difficult conditions that both teams had to play in.
Yeah, I was in Newport on Saturday afternoon ahead of the Ireland and Wales Women's Six Nations game on Sunday, and I just got into my hotel. I was having a bit of lunch, and I had on one TV. It was the 2 euro. You know, it was Connacht and Bulls followed by, or Connacht and Stormers followed by Munster against the Bulls on one screen, and then on the laptop I had the other AIL semi-finals on as well. It was a lot going on. But in terms of Division 1A, Birch, like the standard has never been better. The standard might have been a bit tougher maybe back in your day. I'd say it was you'd want to be fairly hardy to get out there. But like the standard and skills of rugby, the style of rugby being played is so adventurous now. It's so, I suppose, intellectual. It's so advanced.
Yeah, it's much better, Neil. It's moved on no end, and you've seen players move, you know, quite freely from AIL up to URC level, and you know, not look out of place in any way. There's a lot of good young talent, and talent as well that basically have given up on the hope of playing professional rugby. Although, you know, Ivan Soroka's story.
Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah,
that shows that you should never give up. But in terms of a chance to play at the highest level, but yeah, there's guys there who potentially could have did, who are now in careers, but still very much committed to playing club rugby and getting the enjoyment out of that and performing to the best of their ability. So I think the standard, as you said, it's the way they want to play as well. I would say I haven't seen any team who don't have a real positive attitude to playing with ball in hand or playing attacking rugby. And it's grown in popularity. I think COVID helped it. People reconnected with their clubs, and that community aspect of it, but also the jeopardy, the drama, the excitement, and the quality of rugby is second to none. And hopefully we get a really good final. Last year's final was incredibly dramatic, and you know, a great spectacle, and you've got two clubs who've been there before plenty of times. We had two unbelievably tight semi-finals as well, so I don't think there's that in between these teams. I'm looking forward to watching on Sunday.
Yeah, and even like I've said it, obviously, you know, I'm a member down in Terenure, and I've had three absolutely cracking days out over the last 3 years going to those finals with mates and stuff like that from the club, and they were lucky enough to win it on one of those occasions as well. It's just such a fantastic day out. And, you know, now I'm looking forward this Sunday to just heading along as a neutral and seeing a couple of good games of rugby. Before we move on from the Division 1A, 1B playoff, Johnny, is like Saturday afternoon. Nina against UCC, sorry. Yeah, they beat City of Armagh at the weekend. Yeah. Just from your own experiences of playing against those sides this season, who do you fancy to go up? Nina have been thereabouts all season.
Yeah, Nina have been there all more or less all season, kind of in that second spot. They beat UCC kind of just after Christmas. UCC got held up over the line kind of last play, and it was one they didn't close out. UCC are probably the form team in our division, I would say, though, in terms of the run they've been on in the last 4 to 5 games. They've had number bonus point wins, and to go up to Armagh, which is a really, really difficult place to try and get a win, played there for a number of years. It's kind of, I would fancy UCC just because of the form they're in and having done that away from home. They have the under-20s guys back in as well. They're just on a bit of a crest of a wave at the moment, and momentum is certainly behind them. Nina had a good win against Rock, who as well have been kind of thereabouts all year. So it'll be very, very tight. But again, it's funny, if they played it on the 4G in Nina, you'd probably fancy UCC a bit more. If they played it on the main pitch with the weather, you'd probably fancy Nina a bit more. But two really, really high-level sides and very contrasting styles. Need a big physical, grind you down, score a lot of points because they just don't make any mistakes. Where UCC, very free flowing, kind of have a bit of an attitude, even though Tomas wouldn't like me saying it. Kind of, you know, you score 50, we'll score 51 is kind of how they approach it, really. But yeah, that'll be a cracker as well.
Yeah, it certainly will be. And will be some story for a club like Nina to,
to
get up to 1A, given where they've come from. Probably a junior club not too long ago in the in the not-so-distant past. Yeah. Let's move it on to the URC, because we actually do have tons to get through this week. Leinster running wild against Ulster. Munster lose a fairly dour game to the Bulls, and Connacht beaten in dramatic fashion by the Stormers. Starting with Munster's defeat to the Bulls, 16-13, because it had the talking point of the week. Bernard, is the standard of officiating in the URC getting worse?
Yeah, I think it is. There's rarely a week that I don't see something in a game that I wonder how they missed that. And previous to the fiasco with the Munster being punished with an extra man off, that it shouldn't have been. I just thought the free kick, free kick on the back of the scrum with the number eight using his knee. I just go, how can, like, and I heard Jack Crowley saying it to him as he went to take the restart, and I'm just wondering how that can happen with ref mics and the TMO not being able to call in. Like, do they not know the rule? Like, because that's not a breakdown. That's not like something that there's a lot
It's not a subjective call.
No. I don't know if he knew the rule.
It's
black and white. Yeah, exactly. But when Jack said it to him, he didn't go, gee, you're right here. You know what I mean? He basically batted him away. And then obviously we had the shambles with the yellow card. But it's really difficult, I think, to manage these referees when you have so many different referee managers for each country. You know, I don't think the Premiership referees are a million miles better than the URC referees, but they're a lot more consistent in how they referee games. So you watch Bath v Bristol tonight, and you watch Leicester v Exeter tomorrow. You'll see similar decision making processes. You'll see, and that's because they get together on a Monday and they review it together,
Similar levels of communication.
Yeah, 100%. So coaches and players, they're never going to be happy, but they trust more that there's going to be some consistency there. And if there's an outlier, if some referee goes wild one weekend, you know, you're aware of that, and you watch it the following week, and you see, is that going to be part of their decision making? But what we're seeing in the URC, I think, is unfortunately it's really starting to frustrate players, coaches, players. I'm sure referees are frustrated as well, but players, coaches, and supporters are all starting to lose confidence, and that's not a good thing. But I mean, Johnny, you we chatted last night. I mean, you know, you said at the AAL level, this wouldn't happen.
No, like, you know, Kevin Beggs sends out every 2 months. He'll send out, you know, the sheet that Bert's posting on Twitter. Basically, he goes, these are the rules. Have that laminated. Have it at your fourth official, and if there's any confusion, go to the chart. So the game will stop, and the ref will come over to the touch judge and fourth official. They'll look at that and they'll go, yeah, fine, okay, on we go. And like we've had, and this is because there have been incidences like this happen in the AIL. And to be fair, you know, the referees put their hand up and they're like, yeah, that's not good enough. But they communicated correctly to the club, so they tried to help out the referees as much as possible and make a situation like that as easy as can be. And like, I think the whole team in those two particular instances need to actually take a bit of a rap across the knuckles. Both touch judges are AIL referees. The fourth official as well, their referee, but the TMO, particularly on the one off the knee. Like, if, you know, my son did that at under nines, the coach would be like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, next week on Saturday, there's going to be a raft of under nines trying to do that, like, on a thing. And the coaches would be like, ah, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
But their reaction is going to be, oh, sure, they got away with it on Saturday. Like, you know, like, it's not, I just don't think that that's okay. And then also, like, I know of incidences in the AIL where coaches actually walked onto the pitch in an incident like this and said, whoa, 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 hold on. You're wrong here. Whether they played for 30 seconds or a minute and asked to speak to the referee, had a, like, a honest, open, not like, just clear, controlled, calm conversation with them, and they ended up on the at the right side. So there's also, I think, a bit more from the Munster management that they could have been a bit more vocal about it. Two players walk off together. One player doesn't walk off with a physio. Like, you know, there has to be some level of, you know, collective responsibility in all of this. And whether it was a mistake by the management that they didn't know, well, they weren't kicking a fuss on the sideline for 14 minutes. You know, like, it's not a difficult rule. As we said, like, it's black and white. It's not like, say, the Abrahams potential turnover in the first half where he kind of has his left hand slightly on his jersey and the referee says no clear release. The referee can give you, you know, well, I was this side, there was a player here and all I saw was his arm on the jersey. You know, he doesn't have clear... There's a conversation there and there's a grey area because different people see different things. The referee is looking at five different things, whether the tackler rolls away, what way it rolled, where the clean is coming from, does he have release, is he on the ball, is he trying to pull the ball? So there's five things that he's looking at. So, and that's in 1 second. So you give him a bit of leeway on those because, like anything, that's opinion. And he'll follow what he sees in his instinct. These two things, like, they're black and white. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. And, like, the TMO, like, he has Google in front of him. Like, you know, like, it's not hard. Like, you know, like, if there's any question, enter on your phone. Anyone, listen, enter on your phone. Uncontested scrum law. Like, it's one of the first things that comes up.
Mm. And, like, what I find mad is, Andrea Piardi, the referee, said it in the moment where he's trying to explain it to the captains. He said, you know, there's too many rules in this game. And a lot of people will try, say, rugby is a very complicated game, needs to be simplified. There are a lot of different, you know, on the face of it, the when should you go to uncontested scrums and how many players should have to drop off is, in theory, a complicated situation because there are so many instances. But World Rugby, as you've kind of said, have actually simplified it perfectly so that there is a little chart that is available on World Rugby's website. You posted it on X on Saturday afternoon, Birch, and you can use your two fingers to find this instance, and they come together in the middle, and this is what happens. It's actually simple, and a 10-year-old could follow it.
Yeah, whatever type of learner you are, visual or whatever, it's covered, it's ticked all the boxes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very complex situation that is actually explained really, really simply.
Yeah, and I actually feel for Piardi here because he has to trust the fourth official to look after that.
Yeah.
You know,
like, yeah. Realistically, I would have in, like, for, I would have an issue with him on the try.
Yes.
Where he's in front of that and should be able to see it. When it comes to the substitution stuff, I do think, in fairness to Piardi, he has to concentrate on the game.
Yeah.
His officials on the sideline should have been on top of that.
100%. And that's, they only have to be experts. The fourth official only has to be experts on the rules of replacements. You know, that's what really frustrates PRD and the URC. And unfortunately for Munster, this is the second time mm-hmm. this has happened to him, which is, it's incredible, when, you know, when it doesn't happen very often because it is quite clear. And to be fair, like, every person in the ground, whether you had a radio commentary, ref mic, whatever, you knew that Ollie Yeager was obviously a HIA. You know, like, it wasn't the marginal one where, you know, he went off holding his shoulder, but it was a HIA. Like, it was literally, that was a HIA. And once that happened, if anything happened to Archer, it was going uncontested because Munster didn't have a third tight head like Ireland do with Keane Healy. Mm-hmm. And it was going to have to go uncontested, but they wouldn't have to be punished by having an extra, or having gone out of 14. Like, and a game that tight, like, I know Munster weren't brilliant and the Bulls defended well, but you would have to argue that, you know, with an extra man, with 15 players, Munster potentially could have won that game. And you know, the consequences now, if Munster aren't to make top 8, which I think they will, but make a top 4 looks incredibly difficult. And that's revenue, that's, you know, it decreased your chance of getting through to the semi-final. It's horrendous. I look, there's people say referees will tell you it evens out over the year. It's when you're the one.
But it's 2-0 now against Munster. On that front.
When you're the one who's suffering, it's hard to accept that. It's like a coach I had before, and when you didn't get picked and you went to see him, he used to say, "Oh, the cards didn't fall for you." And who's drawing the deck? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
there's no, okay, fair enough. But like, give me something more than that. But just saying, leaving out over the season or a couple of seasons isn't much good to Graham Rowntree or Peter Mahoney or Conor Murray, who's played her last season. You know,
no, or the business of Munster Inc. Like, yeah. You know, it's that's the reality of it. It's professional sport, and not having a home quarterfinal or the ability to generate revenue and potentially move a game or fill out Thomond Park, like, it has massive, massive consequences. And like, saying, you know, the, like, I actually thought when he says, he was quite flippant in his explanation to the captains, there's too many rules in this game, and then, oh, you know, we're still level, so nothing happened. What? No, like, there's 14 people against 15. Those 14 lads are absolutely knackered now. it's not a flippant situation, you know, in my opinion.
And I, as you said, I think because it's the second time it's happened to Munster now, and look what had happened at Croke Park, as frustrating as it was, it was maybe like a 3 or 4 minute situation. And I know they did concede a lot of points in it, but for it to happen twice in a season is, it just gets to, you can excuse it maybe happening once, you can forgive and forget, but when it happens twice,
Wig came down to the touchline there.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't anyone on the touchline. Mm. Yeah. So I'm not dogging the lads out of it, but I would question that. You know, I would question that. This has happened already.
Mm-hmm. Why did it take 14 minutes essentially?
Yeah. Yeah. Where in Croke Park, it took the time for Wig to get from the box down to, you know, down to the sideline. You know?
Yeah, and just apart from the 14 men, you know, they ended up with two hookers on the field.
Yeah, they're line-out.
At the same time. So from a line-out point of view, you know, it is different. Like, Lee Barron wouldn't have lifted in the line-out from an attacking point of view. It's just little small things like that.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, Lee Barron gives you more mobility, but... And Munster's lineup creaked again, you know.
Yeah.
So I'll
point out though, and like, to move it on to the game itself, this is probably a good opportunity to do that. I had it noted here, the lineout creaked obviously because of that. The lineout was struggling, was Bring inconsistent that. Before yeah. that during the match as well.
Yeah.
In my opinion, so it obviously contributed to it, but I don't think it excuses, obviously, the defeat and the Munster performance more than the defeat.
No. The Munster performance was very, very lateral, very lethargic, very lacking any real punch. Now, in fairness, we know that the Bulls, if they're switched on, they have the power game and the physicality. And in fairness to them, unfortunately for them, they are quite inconsistent. I know they're up the top of the table, but they've, like, the game against Leinster, which they won in the end, they weren't impressive at all, really, you know. So Jake White is frustrated. He's hoping they come in a late run. But to be fair to Jake White, how he sees the game and how he sets his team up and the qualities that they have, it's the worst possible opposition for Munster. Them and Edinburgh, actually. Like, Edinburgh had that scrum that was completely dominant. Mm-hmm. Edinburgh have a fair bit of punch. And Munster lacked that. They lacked that... In their profile of their players, you know. And when you have a team like the Bulls, who were just content to kick, when they kick long, they kick chase really well to take away Takir Abraham's, you know, threat. They obviously seen what he did to La Rochelle. When they kick the contest, again, they put pressure to counteract if they didn't win the ball back. And Munster just just a little, and then they'd Munster have a set piece launch really to put off, and they had a scrum that was under pressure, and so Munster need reinforcements. There's absolutely no doubt. Like Clayton McMillan will come in, incredibly impressive, but you know he needs more than the two lads. The first Dan Kelly's coming in as well, but they probably need 10 players in total. I would say, to be able to compete with those teams, because the way they play is great if you're up against a team who can't squeeze you. But unfortunately, there is three or four teams in this competition, and there's definitely four or five in Europe who can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like their kicking game was a big, like they lost the kick-kick battle. You know, every time the Bulls kick long, they were getting the ball back a zone or two in front, or when they went contestable, they were picking the scraps up. They were winning the ball in the air, or they were making it an absolute mess at the breakdown. And then it's very hard, Munster's kicking game, they were kind of forced to kick on the back foot. And in conditions like that, with no set piece, it just, the pressure, just, it was like a siege. They kept coming forward and kept advancing, even though Munster stayed in the game and had their opportunity towards the end. But they were out on their feet towards the end and chasing, you know, 3 points. At that stage in those conditions when the weather had really turned, like it looked really bad. Was it really bad down there, Bert? Was it live?
Yeah, it wasn't. No, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad.
Wasn't that, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was as bad as it seemed, like with the way the game unfolded, but it wasn't as bad as it looked.
Okay.
Final point on Munster, because we've to get through the other teams as well. It's remarkable how just like a few points in the bank changes things, Bert. Like,
yeah.
Put 4 points on Munster's tally at the moment, and they have what looks like a pretty healthy total, and you'd reckon they're fairly set for the playoffs. But because there's so many teams in there, and all of these teams are actually kind of playing each other over the next few weeks, like, you're Munster now, you're really looking over your shoulder. And a game against Cardiff this Friday night, like, the sooner you put points on the board, the better, because you do not want to be going into those last couple of games against Ulster and Benetton as well. Down in Cork, needing a win.
Yeah, it's, and look, we can't take for granted that Munster will come in a late run, which they have done over the last couple of years. And the Bulls game, while it was a difficult game, it was an ideal opportunity to get those points in. URC have released a graphic, and we saw 3 rounds to go, race to the 8, locked in, Leinster, Glasgow, Bulls, but then everybody else is in the hunt except the Dragons. You know, so literally, it's unbelievably competitive to get into that top 8. And Munster now, they're in a dogfight. They're in a dogfight, and you would expect them to come out of it. I mean, it was tough on them after that Bordeaux to try and get back emotionally. But the worrying for me is the scrum isn't brilliant, the lineout is poor, and they don't have a huge amount of real power ball carriers at the moment in the front five. So, the way the game is in terms of set piece and collision, it's hard. It's hard to run away from that. It's hard to run away from that. And Munster try and do, and they're well organized to do that, and their shape is lovely and well, like, good detail. But just if you're organized defensively and you don't bite in like the Bulls didn't, you can see kind of Munster losing a little bit of energy through attack. You know, they're, phase after phase, they're starting to run out of numbers. So I still think they'll manage to get it done, but it's a nervy time for them. It's a nervy time for them now. And obviously, with, you know, your coach isn't there. Everyone knows the man who's going to be making the decision next year isn't there. I'm fascinated to see how they turn it around.
Really will be. And I think in general, I know we were giving out about the URC's officiating there for a while, but in terms of the playoff race, every game seems to be just must watch TV. I was watching Edinburgh and Sharks on Friday night. Absolutely cracking game. Just like brilliant Friday night entertainment. And I'm sure over the next few weeks, we're going to have, you know, a couple of dozen of those kind of matches as well. Leads us into Leinster and Ulster from Saturday night, Johnny. 41-17 to Leinster. I think once we saw the teams and how loaded Leinster were on the bench, we probably expected they were going to run away with that game in the end. But just in general, in terms of the overall vibes of Leinster at the moment, they do seem to be in a better place than they were this time last year and this time the year before, even though in both of those situations they were also in a Champions Cup semi-final and pretty much locked into first or second place in the URC.
Yeah, like they're playing with smiles on their faces, even like little things. Like you look at the bench when the camera goes on, they're all slagging each other and stuff. There seems to be a really good vibe. Guys are getting rewarded for performances, which always helps the kind of ethos within the group. And guys, when they get the opportunity, they're performing. You know, Tommy O'Brien's obviously the leading light at the moment. He's pushing his way into probably a summer tour. And also, you know, starting in the Heineken Cup, you know, it was great to see a younger scrum half, someone like Fintan Gunn, come off and show his attributes. Kind of perfect game for him to come off the bench in terms of what he does around the ruck. And Dan Sheehan's third try shows exactly what he can do when he does get on the move. So, yeah, like it's just seems to be a very, very happy camp. And you know, all very much aligned and all pushing towards the same arrowhead. Ulster were, I thought Ulster were really good first half. It was just the power of the bench and, you know, Ulster, you know, having two nines on the pitch then, like little things went against them pre-game and they lost a couple of lads and then it just kind of messes any kind of major plan they had. But like, you know, I thought they were very good. Like, I think Cormac Isichuco was excellent again. Like, he obviously scores, finishes a really good try. That's what he gives you, power, speed, in those open spaces. And, it was just the power that they had coming off the bench. And as you said, you kind of knew that when you saw what the bench was going to be like, when you saw the teams released.
Johnny mentioned Dan Sheehan there, Birch. Something along the lines of 44 tries in 69 Leinster appearances for him. And I remember when he kind of first came on the scene, he was scoring tries at the back of malls every single week, and it was all great. And you know, that kind of pads a stat a little bit. But I feel like in the last 12 to 18 months, he's scoring tries all over the pitch. He's popping up on wings. He's running support lines. He still gets the odd one or two off the back of them all, but he's appearing everywhere on the pitch, like a scrum half running a support line.
Yeah, he's the best hooker in the world at the moment. And I struggle to see a weakness in his game because he's incredibly good at the core functions of a hooker. And also he's really physical in terms of his clean outs and his defensive breakdown work, his tackle work as well is top class. But then he has that X factor, that flair, that sense of where to be. His lines are running. It's just a different level. Like, I mean, I thought Kelleher was in really good form when he got a chance there, early Six Nations, and it was going to be a real battle. But like, this isn't any respect to Ronan, but I don't think anyone could live with Sheehan at the moment, and it's a real challenge for everyone else in Ireland who's looking to compete with him to step up. But like, to score a hat trick coming off the bench, he's outstanding. He's for sure the line starting hooker, but I think he's the best in the world.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Johnny. You're nodding along. I don't think many people would disagree either.
No, like he has everything. He's like an extra centre, like in terms of the wing, like he's. You know what he gives you in those 15-meter channels is just off the charts.
One thing I do want to bring up, found kind of interesting enough little talking point that popped up down in New Zealand. Maybe it's off the back of Leinster picking up another All Black for next season, but Stephen Donald, former All Blacks out half, was speaking in the last few days. He reckons Jordy Barrett shouldn't be starting for New Zealand this summer, because he needs to earn his place back in the side after his stint at Leinster. According to Donald, he says that the URC competition is probably a very, very low level compared to Super Rugby. The Champions Cup certainly would be of the same level. Would I start him? Not necessarily. Nothing to do with his form, but more a reward for the boys who've been in Super Rugby and played well all year. Birch, I will admit I watched Super Rugby in bits and pieces on Fridays and Saturday mornings. I'm not tuning into every single game. Is the URC a low level competition compared to Super Rugby at the moment?
Not at all. Not at all. In actual fact, the defensive systems in URC would actually be more rigid, more set in stone than in Super Rugby. Super Rugby is a great product, plenty of skill, plenty of talent, but set piece wise, and I said defensively, and that tactical element is far and above. And you know, at first hand, I've seen coaches come over from Super Rugby and be shocked at the level of tactical knowledge, the systems they need to put in place for teams to compete in the Northern Hemisphere competition. So Stephen Donald, like, either he doesn't know much about it, or he's just trying to make clickbait, but he's totally inaccurate there. And that's not knocking Super Rugby. Super Rugby is a good competition in its own right, but the URC would compete in that. And people in South Africa, sorry, people in New Zealand and Australia feel, who are working in Super Rugby, feel it's gone backwards since the South Africans pulled away. You know, so, there's lots of talented players in there, but in terms of actual detail, the Northern Hemisphere and the URC and the Champions Cup in particular are more advanced, you know, more advanced. And that makes it very comparable then, because whereas there might be the same amount of X factor, the level of the detail around the systems that you want in attack and defence make it comparable, I think.
And I think also as well, it is worth noting, Jordy Barrett has played 3 URC games so far this season. He's played 6 in the chat, you know, 6 of his 9 games for Leinster have been in the Champions Cup. I know that that number might even out over the next couple of months or so by the end of the URC season. But Johnny, if you're talking about standard, like I put this to Tyler Blaindall yesterday, he obviously coached in Super Rugby for 4 years before coming over to Leinster last season. He gave the diplomatic answer of, to say Jordy wouldn't be up to speed going back, I'm not sure I'd agree with that. That's kind of where he left it. But if you think about Jordy Barrett here is working with Jacques Nienaber on a weekly basis. He's in a Leinster squad that contains 20 to 25 Ireland internationals plus RG Snyman and Rabah Slimani. I reckon standard-wise he's doing okay.
Yeah, and I also think what he's going to take back will also add to any environment he goes back into. Mm. So if he goes back into the All Blacks, like giving an example of what Jack Nienaber and how New Zealand have potentially struggled against South Africa under that defensive system. Ireland, obviously, they had up until the World Cup and last autumn, you know, had New Zealand's number for... So, like... You know, what he's going to bring back in terms of the knowledge that other guys and the experiences that other guys don't have, I think he'll actually add more to any environment he goes into, because, you know, he's bringing back new things, new ideas, and possibly a new way of looking at the game.
Yeah, might just be one of those slow news weeks where we've been reeled in, I reckon, and just took the bait. But anyway, on Ulster... Like, Sharks this week, Bernard, mathematically, they won't be done if they lose it. They've got Munster the following week, and is it Edinburgh the week after? I might be getting jumbled up in their final games. Mathematically, they're not done if they lose this. They fell to 10th after the defeat to Leinster, but it does feel like, this being a home game, if they don't get over the line this weekend, they are facing a real, real battle across the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, it'll be incredibly tough for them. The season could peter out, and just obviously, look, they've announced yesterday the players departing, and it's quite a
transition. The transition is really continuing now this summer.
It is, and you know, they've obviously signed Augustus, but there hasn't been a raft of signings. Certainly, in that raft of signings that you would like to see when you're losing, like, so. The Cooney and Alan O'Connor and Matty Ray and Kieran Treadwell and Andrew Warwick, you know, players who have a big influence on the field. These aren't all fringe players who are moving on. And I think it's a sign of the financial squeeze, you know, the financial squeeze that's happening across 3 or 4 provinces, and making the life for head coaches incredibly tough, you know, like Richie Murphy's gone up there, to try and get Ulster back to where they are, you know, contenders for URC, where they want to be, contenders for URC, potentially getting back towards semi-finals of Europe. And he has some good young talent, but I really hope he gets back in the transfer market now to be able to replace those players, because I think we saw at the weekend, I know they went 6-2 and it didn't work and had some injuries, etc., but that Leinster bench was very strong, but that starting team weren't Leinster's first choice team, and they dealt with Ulster quite comfortably. So I really hope also that they can get a good performance and a win against the Sharks, just to keep them alive and try and get something positive out of the end of the season. But I am worried for Ulster, obviously, you know, naming rights to the stadium, financial pressures. It's not where you want one of your big provinces to be.
And I think you kind of nodded along, Johnny, as that was going on, particularly around Alan O'Connor and Andrew Warrick. Because like you look at someone like John Cooney and Kieran Treadwell, and I think those players leaving is a very understandable thing, where they're maybe getting on a little bit in their careers. Their Ireland international ambitions have kind of fallen away. They've got a nice opportunity to go away. For Treadwell, it's kind of returning home to yeah. Harlequins and getting an opportunity to play there. For John Cooney, it's getting to experience something different and probably a nice paycheck alongside with it as well. But for Alan O'Connor and Andrew Warrick, two like stalwarts that,
yeah,
like 200 plus caps each. And the worrying thing would be, it's not as if they have fallen off the radar this season and are being let go. They're still being leaned on heavily. Both players have played 14 games this season. They're still very much part of the first team week in, week out this season, but aren't going to be around next season.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, particularly those two, as you said, Neil, given the kind of how often they're used and how, you know, reliable they have been in terms of their performance, no injuries, and it's an interesting one in terms of what's behind them, what's coming through. Is, you know, Richie's obviously by the players that are going, is, you know, going to completely revamp everything and build them around, you know, building around a potential younger generation and go on a thing. But it's particularly the Alan O'Connor one, and Mark, they kind of struck me as like, oh, that was a big, big surprise. You as you say, you understand all the other ones, but those two guys. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens with them, but then where they're going to get their replacements. Are they coming from within, or are they coming from other provinces, or are they going out to the market? And you know, markets for second rows and props it's a difficult place at the moment, and it's an expensive place as well.
Just on this, I think sometimes fans see this and they think, oh, Richie Murphy, well, Johnny's point there, Richie Murphy wants to put his own shape on a rebuild of the squad. And I don't have any inside track on this, but I do know sometimes all the time head coaches have to hit a number, you know, a total spend.
Yeah.
If that's reducing, well, you kind of have to get rid of players who are decent earners, you know, to get to your number. So, you know, whether it was Kitchoff being allowed leave, you know, to free up some cash, or a situation like this. And I know that Dan McFarland, like even back when Dan was coaching, there was budget pressure where certainly the players had to leave that to basically fit into a number. And I think this is the challenge for David Humphreys, is that my understanding is that, you know, money isn't as freely available as was maybe under David Nusafora. A lot of money was spent leading towards that World Cup bid. And he now has to be the one who puts a bit more shape on it and manners on it. And I think at a time when you look at the URC table today, and we'll see where it is at the end of the season, but realistically, three of the four provinces, to our eye, you would say, could do a little bit of help. I know it doesn't normally happen, but you know, nearly like a conclave to elect the Pope, that they would get together everybody in professional rugby and try and work out a really coherent retention recruitment strategy for the next three or four years, to try and support the four provinces, but realistically to support more the other three at the moment, to just give Richie Murphy the tools to go and actually do what he needs to do. Like, we've had the season where we've had, you know, two interim coaches in the four provinces. That's not like Irish rugby. And if it happened in French rugby, you wouldn't bat an eyelid, because They're used to this electroshock, you know, type stimulation. But in Irish rugby, we tend to be a little bit more medium to long term focused on our planning. And I think the head coaches, Roundtree and Pete Wilkins or whatever, maybe they're the ones who've had to try and manage a squad, and the expectations haven't dropped, but the squads aren't as strong as we historically associate with Munster, Connacht, and Ulster as well. This squad Ulster have this year isn't as strong as 3 or 4 years ago. And yet now we're just seeing a load of players leave who you would say, because of the game time they're getting, they're obviously good enough to be better than some of the players who are staying. And how is that going to work out? Obviously, some young players will come through, and that's a good thing. But it's a lot of talent to lose in a season where, you know, you probably lacked a bit of talent.
Yeah, and there is a squeeze. I do know there is a squeeze on the provinces from the RFU around, I suppose, trying to, where you have players like an O'Connor or a Warwick who aren't necessarily on the Irish international radar, but whose wages have probably progressively gone up year on year on year over the last 10 years or so, and would be pretty good earners. There's probably questions from the RFU coming down of, okay, what are you spending on players who are on the radar of the national team? And I think that's where the pressure is coming on. Similar to Connacht last season, where the likes of Tom Farrell, Tom Daly would have had to be let go. Gavin Thornbury, you know, pretty surprising players to be left out. I might move it on to Connacht on that, actually, because 34-29 against the Stormers at the weekend. I know you were covering the game, Bernard, as well on Saturday. You liken Connacht, obviously, to Kevin Keegan's Newcastle at one point, which is pretty appropriate. I would just recommend that Connacht fans get regular checkups with their GP, because it cannot be healthy having to go through that every single week. The last 20 minutes of every Connacht game are just complete and utter chaos.
Yeah, they
I hope they make the playoffs. I hope their results improve, but at the same time, I kind of hope they never change.
No, I don't think they will. I don't change this year anyway, because I think that's all they know. It's built in them. And look, I think it's going back to some of Andy Friend's time. They weren't as consistent in this need or capacity to give you drama, but there was times when they showed that. This year, it's just been pretty consistent all year. And it's very hard to be angry with them if you're a Connacht fan, because they do show a lot of character. You know what I mean? Like, they show a lot of fight against Munster and McHale Park, against Racing, against the Stormers. Yes, it's hard not to be angry with them as well, because they allow teams get ahead of them and pull away and score soft tries. And they find themselves in the end where, you know, they score a try, but there has been crossing in the movement and the opportunity goes. But my big thing with them is their capacity to concede points so easily. Like, RT showed a graphic of the stats comparing Connacht to all the other teams in the URC, and nearly all the attacking metrics, they're in the top two or three. Some of them are one. And I said it beforehand, that's unusual for a team on a low budget. You know, usually the best attacks of the team who spend the most. They're the ones with the internationals. They're the ones with the pace, the power, etc. And Connacht and teams of Connacht's spending in the budget normally are good set piece, good kicking game, defence, gritty, breakdown, etc. Hard to score against. And they're the complete opposite, which is really interesting. But unfortunately for Connacht, it's not getting them in the position in the league table that they want to be, or not getting them the wins. But I think the Lions were horrendous at the weekend. They seem to have down tools completely. So Connacht will actually, you know, another week in South Africa, they'll be gutted, but they'll actually feel a lot better than they did probably heading down to South Africa on the Monday without so many key players after that Racing defeat, and salvaged a really good performance. 2 points. They could get 5 this week and be right back in it, Neil. Like, you know, I was writing them off after this tour, before this tour, because I said they'll get maybe 2 points out of the tour. You know, 2 losing bonus points. Or sorry, 2 5 or 4 try bonuses I was giving them. But now I think they could get 7 and be right back in it. But then, do I trust them then to go and close it out Not at the moment. Yeah, it's a weird, it's a kind of a weird relationship to have watching Connacht. Is that it's hard to be really critical of them, because as I said, they show fight, they show character, show resilience. You know they don't have the budget of everyone else, yet the things that don't really require a budget, they actually let you down on. But then, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And Johnny, like I liken it to, as Bernard says, like it's hard to actually get angry with them, because just the way they seem to finish games, you almost you feel good for them because of what you've seen in those last 20 minutes. I liken it to, I don't know, do you play golf? But you could play an absolutely brutal 17 holes, and then you smoke a driver down the 18th fairway. And when you're getting into your car after the round, that's the one shot you're thinking of.
Yeah,
that's why you want to go back and play again next Saturday.
Yeah, as a neutral, they're brilliant to watch. Like their attack, I've said it all year, their attack is just off the charts. But then, you know, like they concede a try off a 5-meter scrum where the number 8 picks and just scored. Like, you know, stuff like that. It's a real, real sucker punch for them. And then to do it in the fashion in the last 2 minutes, getting brought back, scored the try. Like all I had in my mind is Bert saying last week, you know, this is Carty's opportunity to drive it home over. And I was like, he's going to get his opportunity. And then you just see the replay and you're just like, oh. But yeah, like, look, 2 points is massive for them with how tight we saw how far Munster dropped down after not getting a win this weekend. So it's so tight. Like if they can get 7 points out of 2 weeks, yeah, it's great. Like that 2 points is huge for them. Absolutely massive. So they have a chance, and they, you know, enjoy themselves down in South Africa, a bit of nice weather away from the wind and rain here at the moment, and, you know, hopefully get a job done this weekend.
And the bonus points, Birch, that is actually worth talking about, because as you said, like the heart they always show, and talking about their heart and their commitment and their refusal to give up, that's not just kind of empty platitudes, because it has actually been worth a lot of points to them over the season. Yeah. They've only won 5 games this season, but they've picked up 15 bonus points in 15 games. Yes. That's more than any other team in the entire competition. If you could look back maybe on 3 or 4 of those matches over the course of the season where they either pick up a late losing bonus point or maybe even 2 late losing bonus points like they would have done at the weekend, if they sneak into the playoffs, you're looking back at a handful of those games as the reason they've got in. Because in any other season with 5 games out of 15, they're out of contention for playoffs already.
Yeah, no, and they are incredible at keeping going. As Johnny said, they get a lot of, you back them to score 4 tries against nearly anybody. But ordinarily it's wins that give you that feel good factor that drive you to the next week, that keeps coaches in their jobs. And they, you know, that'd be the big frustration for them, is that at key moments in games, composure, an ability to stop momentum for the opposition, they just seem to be totally devoid of that. And, you know, next year for them, you know, at the moment it seems Jack Carty's moving on or retire leaving Connacht. JJ is gone, you know. Are they going to go into next season with Ford and Ione?
And speaking of that, you mentioned like Ulster, for example. Aside from Augustus, we haven't seen much recruitment. We've seen nothing from Connacht.
No, we've seen nothing yet. And even in the rumor mill, like there's no chat about them.
I can't tell you a player they've been linked with actually off the top of my head.
Yeah, but if you think about it, the fact of, you know, Pete was on sick leave. Obviously, you know, Billy Millard was coming in as GM, but he's working for Harlequins. There's a lack of kind of clarity around where they're going or who's doing what. So, but again, that's not great if you're a Connacht player or a Connacht fan. But I think that's the only. I mean, maybe they don't have a lot of money to spend. Maybe they don't have a lot of money to spend. Probably not actually. Probably not as well. So you got that to add to it, but. And they have done a good job of bringing through the Devines, the Fords, the Tracys, you know,
Hugh Gavins,
etc. So there's no, that's not a criticism. That's a good thing. But you still would. It'd just be interesting if they're going to just continue with bringing players through from the academy, or they're going to add, you know, four or five players there. To lose two tens, and not replace him with any would be unusual, but yeah, we'll find out. We'll find out over the next couple of months, I suppose.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it. They're playing the Lions this weekend. That's where we'll leave it for this week's URC chat, fellas. Loads of rugby coming up on your screens over the next few days. And up next on the podcast, Hannah O'Connor on Women's Six Nations. Now then, round four of the Guinness Women's Six Nations is in the books. Ireland 40-14 winners away to Wales on Sunday. And one final outing coming up this Saturday, away to Scotland, 2:30 p.m. at the Hive in Edinburgh. As usual, Hannah O'Connor is with me. Hannah, how are you?
I'm good, Neil. And yourself?
I'm very well. You're enjoying the Easter holidays still?
Yeah, milking the Easter holidays for the last week. That's in it now before reality bites back next week.
Good stuff. On Ireland, then, four games played, one to go. Ireland with two big bonus point wins so far, two defeats, which probably would have been expected, albeit with hindsight, they might have wanted to win that game against France. To start with, through these opening four games, so with all that said, are Ireland tracking above what you were expecting? Are they below what we were expecting? Are they about level par for four matches?
Yeah, I'd say they're tracking probably where I would have expected them to track based on where they've come out of it with the WXV1s. I think the performance they put in there was all about layering. I know we talked about it before in terms of like they're only as good as their last performances, and it was key for them to come in with the same kind of momentum and to keep building to show that the stuff they did in Canada wasn't just a flash in the pan. So I think they've done that. I think obviously, as you said there, you touched upon, they'll have wanted more out of the French game. But I think apart from that, the victories have been quite comprehensive against the Italy's and the Wales so far. And I think it's quite telling of a side of where they are and where they're going that they come away from a 40-14 victory against Wales away from home and they're frustrated. I think that's a great place to be for a team that's kind of on the ascendancy versus a team like Wales who are kind of at the rebuilding stage of the depths of where they are maybe a little bit as well.
And it goes along with what Scott Beaman and the players would have said over the last month or 6 weeks or so, that the goal this year is to prove they're closing the gap, even if it's just a little bit, to the top two, to England and France. And like, while one side of that is your performances against England and France and showing you can do it, then the other side of it is it's all well and good putting up spirited performances against those teams, but you also have to prove you're creating distance with the group behind you as well. And I suppose the wins against Italy and Wales are showing that Ireland are starting to put a little bit of daylight between themselves and the others.
Yeah, and I think that was the big thing the girls would have wanted out of this. They wanted to really kick on away from those teams. And we touched upon it at the start of the campaign that like you're only as good as each performance that you put in against these teams. And perhaps over the last number of years, I know me and you talked about it last week, that like we've played England and then we've kind of limped to a finish against Scotland, sometimes 2 years ago losing, last year winning, the year before another. It's always been a kind of a very lethargic flat match where it's like either team can win it, and it's never been that much of a spectacle even up until last year. So I think that's probably the most pleasing thing for the girls, that like you mentioned it last week, that these three games are almost like a little truncated World Cup to get that feel for like three big group games in a row, bumper to bumper, no rest, get the bodies through it, get the mentality up and get the bodies in the right kind of frame of mind to go at it. And I think that's probably what's most pleasing, is that they've showed that bounce back now from the likes of the England, where, yeah, you could have, you know, said that the second half got away in us completely and the scoreline doesn't quite reflect what the game was like. But I think what the messaging and what the girls have come out and said, they were very much looking at that first half of the England game as the positives, but also the work-ons within the first half rather than the second half, where it's perhaps just a power game where the bench just overcame us. But I think that was quite interesting to see the mindset of that side of things, because it's completely, yes, it's about pushing the gap away from the Wales, the Scotlands and the Italy's, but it's that internal focus of how good can we be? How good can we kind of improve on the things that we know we can improve on? And I think they have showed signs of doing that so far. And like, you can only do it again what's up against you. And I think Sunday was a really, really good example of that for the girls, that they managed to kind of show another big gulf between us and the chasing pack.
Yeah, particularly when there were challenges in that game and it didn't all go smoothly, and they had to recover from a poor start. They had to endure a setback in the game, and that was probably the point of the match where they really actually kicked on and won it, when they had their biggest challenge, when Dana was in the bin. And not really sure like how the scoreline reflects the 80 minutes on Saturday, because my gut would say 40-14. Ireland probably should have actually been pushing up towards 50 and hitting that half century again, because they left chances out there in the first half and particularly in the last quarter when the game was sewn up. But then the flip side is they did also need 20, 25 minutes to get into the game.
Yeah, there's the two sides to it, isn't there? It was unusual in the sense that all the matches that we've watched so far, maybe bar the exception of the French game, a trend has been that Ireland have started really quick. They've started really well. Italy, they came out of the blocks firing, got up a 14-0 lead before Italy even were awake. England started really well despite it being England. And then I suppose the flip side of it, it was a bit of a lethargically flat start to this game where a Boyd Wales side came out. They're at home. They're going to be riled up for it. They kind of score, not really against the head because they were kind of cracking some cracks within the Irish team. And I got kind of an opportunistic try with that kick through from Clecky George, and Amy Lee just was unfortunate with the bounce, just kind of deceived her a little bit. But then, for as you said, for the girls to be able to turn, it's a different picture, I guess. It's a different challenge, and it's something that will stand to them in the long run going into a World Cup, that not every game obviously is the same and all that comes with it. But to be able to kind of eke their way back in and realise that the rooks were a big problem. There were 7 penalties within the first 26 minutes, and I think about 6 of them for rook infringements against Ireland. So to be able to flip that switch, I think in years gone by, it might have been like a trend throughout the whole game that we couldn't have gotten a grip on, and maybe the composure would get the better of us and it would be kind of panic stations a little bit at times. But to have that composure, to be able to fix it on the fly, adapt to it, and be able, as you said, to, even with Dan O'Brien's yellow card, to be able to be, you know, 14-7 up, then Dana goes off for the yellow and it's still then 21-7 going into halftime. That was a kind of a big swing and a kind of a big statement from Ireland as to, yes, we can adapt to these kind of bumps that come and be able to kind of swerve by them and get on with the rest of the game.
You mentioned the breakdown there, and that was the really interesting one early on. And it was something myself and Fiona were talking about on commentary before the game, of like how Ireland would adapt to Aaron King being absent. And
yeah,
obviously the line out was such a big thing with her early on in the tournament, because she was the primary option for Cleena Maloney and for Niamh Jones as well. But her work rate around the pitch and around the breakdown was massive as well. Like, she was leading the championship for ruck arrivals on both attack and defence. Yeah. So it was going to be really interesting to see who picked that up. And as you mentioned, it took Ireland pretty much the guts of the full first half to figure out what they were doing. You could see Molly Scuffle-McCabe was having to deal with a lot of messiness. She was having to really, really fight for ball in there, and Wales were going hard after it. And you mentioned the penalties, and I'll look at it here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 penalties against Ireland inside the opening 25 minutes. And five of those were for ruck offences. Like, Wales really went after them in that opening quarter.
And you know what it was? It was Wales would have seen the Aaron King injury and have realised that was a place that they could go after, especially in the back five of the pack that Wales had chosen. You know, I think Gwen Crabb missed out on a selection. She's probably your out-and-out second row. They bumped Georgia Evans, who had been playing back row /8. They bumped her up to second row, really to allow Alex Callender back in the mix. They went for a real back five who were like terriers around that ruck and love nothing more than to go sniffing in a breakdown. So it was a real test to Ireland. Ireland seemed to be deploying the tactic of using the tip-on pass. But when you use the tip-on pass to try to get outside those jacklers, you're also leaving yourself exposed to be a body down in that breakdown because you have to work around quite quick. So it was a bit of a battle of the two kind of sets of tactics going against each other. Ultimately, obviously, Ireland managed to adapt and kind of get up to the speed of the game. They were probably, I heard Enya Breen talking about it, a little bit flat to start off that game, which would have disappointed them a little bit. But, you know, fair play. They had the composure to stick with it and managed to eke the scores out, getting those, the gain line carries being the big thing. I think obviously Wales got the foot in the door early doors with that score. When you look at the stats, I think it's like in the 40 percentages for Wales making gain line carries with their big carriers, which is something they pride themselves on. So Ireland's defence stood firm there versus, I think, 79% of Ireland's being able to get gain line carries in their carries as well. So they're big stats that can have a swinging of a game. It also slows down your ruck. And I think the numbers were in our favour there for that goal ball that we talked about within 0 to 3 seconds. Now, mind you, none of that was happening in the first 20 minutes because of the way Molly Scuffle-McCabe, as you mentioned there, had to go digging, had to go doing some rucking work that you wouldn't want your nine getting involved in. But look, adapt and overcome, it's all part and parcel of the game, I guess, at this stage.
And the middle third of the game is where Ireland, they got their noses in front, and even the yellow card for Dan O'Brien, they just started going more direct. The forward started taking on a lot more responsibilities for carries. They just started to just go forward a metre or two at a time rather than trying to find the touchline really, really quickly and make 20, 30 yards in one go. And Dan O'Brien gets the yellow card. I remember thinking at the time, okay, it was 14-7 at the time, 3.5 minutes until halftime. Okay, get up towards halftime, get in, get refreshed, just kind of settle yourselves back down and work on seeing this out in the second half. And all of a sudden, they just one more chance before halftime. Dorothy Wall scores the try 2 minutes after halftime. She gets in again. It's a bonus point secured by that stage. Dan O'Brien still off the pitch and the game is effectively done.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because as you said about that, like, you would think that most teams would be like batting down the hatches. We're missing our 10. Everything has to narrow up a little bit. But for Ireland to still play the same way, to still, you know, go after it and realise that, as you said, those direct carries are making gain lines. Wales aren't able to live with them. To know that they're getting a bit of now kind of an upper hand, they're getting line out is going smoothly, the scrum is going well, to be able to just kind of benefit from that. And as you said, Dorothy Wall getting that maul try just after halftime was the real kind of nail in the coffin for any comeback that Wales were thinking of kind of reigniting. But yeah, it says a lot about, I suppose, the mentality. I think it was interesting to watch it. It was almost like a psychological battle between two teams. Mm. You saw Wales get the front foot in, and you'd imagine that in any other circumstances, a home team front foot, getting 7-0 up home, get your crowd behind you, everything on the up, against an Ireland team who maybe haven't been used to this or wouldn't be expecting to necessarily be behind. But then you see the difference in the lack of composure that Wales had. There's still a team piecing together the bits of the jigsaw with Sean Lynn of those defensive systems, those attacking systems. He's obviously not going to be able to make those changes overnight. But then you've got an Irish side on the other side who are very content at what they're doing, who all know that they're singing off the same hymn sheet, who know that, fine, we might be a try down here, but we know that this is working. Being able to identify as a kind of a 15 on the pitch that this is working, as you said, stick to our front ball carries, get our big carriers on the ball, then be able to play wide, be able to score off counter-attack, things that they'd be priding themselves on now. It just kind of showed the difference between the two teams. Wales just looked like a team that had no kind of answers once Ireland started to turn the screw and put the foot down. And Ireland seemed very comfortable from then on after the kind of that wall try just before halftime and after halftime.
And it shows as well the evolution in the team. And it's not just this match where we've seen it as well, because first, again, to go back on those first 20 minutes, the thing that was just running through my head was Italy last year, Italy last year, Italy last year, where there was, you know, there were a few instances even where passes out the back just weren't even finding a player. Someone was overrunning it, someone was underrunning it. And I think as well back to the USA game in WXV last year, where I had those similar thoughts in the first half when Ireland were dominating possession and creating loads of chances and leaving so many scores out there. But stayed patient, stayed on task, and eventually got the job done comfortably enough. And we saw that again this weekend. We have seen that big evolution in the mentality, I would say, in the team in the last 12 months.
Yeah, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It takes you to have those matches against the Italys and the USAs to kind of be down there and realise that, damn, we're making a mess of this here. And as you said, those handling errors and those kind of hesitancy we saw, like between Amy Lee and Stacey Flood in the back line, there was a hesitancy on a kick pass option that got us a turnover and got Wales, you know, into our half again. And it's those little bits and pieces that, yeah, a while ago they might have been like deja vu, that you're flooding all the way back to those games where teams come back into it. But I think it's that resilience in the group and knowing that they've got the firepower throughout the pitch and throughout the bench really now that we mightn't have had before, that we just have to stick to it. You know that you've done it before, and like having the ability to say that we've done it against the likes of New Zealand, we've done it for 40 odd minutes against England. We just have to batten down what we know and stick to our processes rather than kind of succumbing to what the opposition are doing to you. So it's a very kind of, I think you can see it in the team as well. It's a very internally focused thing that you're not really worried about what the opposition are doing, because you know if you execute the game plan to your own systems, then you're going to come out the better of the two at the end. So it's a nice sign to see that they're learning from those things.
And in line with that, like it's not even just a mentality thing about the staying patient and sticking on task. It's that by the end of the game, the breakdown where they had been struggling in that opening quarter, they were completely in control of it for pretty much all of the second half. And Wales in the end give up 18 penalties in total. They'd been averaging 8 across those opening three games. By the end of the game, Ireland just absolutely had Wales on toast at the breakdown.
Exactly. And as you said, the devil is in the detail. When you watch the opening kind of 20 minutes exchanges versus the rest of the match where Ireland really, really did get their supporting bodies in there. But huge carries, like you just constantly, and as you said, if it's not broken, don't try fix it. Wales were struggling to live with the latches and the clear outs from Ireland that was making them struggle to fold around. Then the next carry was also dominant because of the lack of bodies being able to get around all of those little pieces. And then you saw, like, case in point, as you said, Linda Dugang's try, like she wouldn't have any more of a walk-in where the bodies just were pummeled to within, just they couldn't do it anymore. And again, it's that kind of stamina piece as well, and staying in the game from a Wales perspective. It's having to deal with that kind of onslaught of pressure from Ireland, but it's also the mental piece has been like, geez, we're losing gain line here every time and we're getting pushed back. And eventually you see Linda, like, she won't get more of a walk in than that. She didn't even have to, you know, she could stay upright for the scoring of the try, which says a lot from 5 meters out, like.
Yeah, and I think for that second, I don't know which one you're talking about. Was it her second one early in the second?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the first one I was talking about, but the second one was a trademark Linda one as well, where they just couldn't live with the sheer power that was coming at them.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention that because I might need to look it back. I'm almost certain it was Ruth Campbell who deserves a lot of, almost like a try assist on that one, because the line she runs inside just takes 2-3 defenders out of the game. And gives Linda Zugang that walk in under the posts as well.
Yeah, you're never stopping her from there.
Yeah, to go back, you said there, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And in line with that, Aoife Wafer, 24 carries, 174 metres, 2 tries. And throw in then as well, 7 tackles, which doesn't sound massively high, but it's on the high side for what Ireland needed at the weekend.
Yeah.
And she had the most opposition ruck entries as well. So she was going after the ball, trying to slow the Welsh ball down as well. Seems to be getting better week on week on week.
Yeah, and that's the thing, the frightening thing with her. And like, look, she is obsessed with rugby. Everything about the game, she is obsessed. But she's a very clever rugby player. You look at her like, and she's a mixture of, you know, if you look at the men's game, a mixture of a lot of back rowers kind of mashed into one. Not only has she got that power game, but she's a really good rugby IQ as well. So if you put 3 bodies in front of her, she's well able to use her hands to get out of danger. She's also probably as quick as some of your backs. She's also got the pace to live with that as well. But she just kind of, you see her popping up on the attack. Like, I think it was her first try, just popping up at the right time. But that's reading the game and knowing that Stacey's going to make that break and being ready on the inside then to pop up where you need to be. But yeah, she's going from strength to strength. But I know I heard Scott Beaman talking about it. And I know from playing with her at club rugby myself and provincially and internationally with her, she's always looking for that extra kind of 1% of where she can improve her game. Like, as I said, she's obsessed by the game. I think she probably has more appreciation for it after her kind of truncated start to her career with big injuries to keep her out for a long time. So there's nothing like that to give you the hunger for it. And yeah, she's riding the crest of a wave at the moment, and hopefully it'll continue. As I said, with someone like Erin King, you know, being missing from that back row, Ireland will definitely need a way for her to keep doing what she's doing. But yeah, as you said, you'd think that she'd have kind of a second season slump with them having watched her in WXV1, but it's definitely not the case. She's going from strength to strength, and yeah, it bodes well for Ireland going forward. And I think someone else who had kind of similar stats, as you said, to that was Dorothy Wall. I think she had a big game as well with terms of carries. She seemed to be everywhere from line out time to being really a willing ball carrier there, which gave Ireland that front football. So yeah, good signs from the pack in general. But yeah, Wafer is kind of a one of a kind in that department, all right.
And you mentioned, like you said, she's like a complete rugby obsessive, always looking for just that every little 1%er to make her game better. And I did have to laugh. I was on the same flight as the team coming back on Sunday night from Bristol. And Hugh Hogan was the defence coach, was sitting about 3 or 4 rows ahead of me. And midway through the just over 1 hour flight, Aoife Wafer walks back the plane holding her laptop and is standing there looking over clips with Hugh Hogan for about 10 or 15 minutes.
Like,
a few hours after the game on a 1 hour flight home from Bristol late on a Sunday night. I was saying, come on, sit down, enjoy your player of the match award. Come on.
I know. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of standard way for Freya. But yeah, as I said, always looking for those gains, and I said she's really enjoying her rugby at the moment, and it's great to see her kind of get that run of kind of injury free, because when she came back from the Six Nations last year, she had a break again, and then he kind of came back to us at Interpros for the end. But the break, she doesn't seem to miss a beat then when she comes back on the pitch. She's kind of straight up to that top level again. So yeah, no, it's great. So hopefully she'll power on now and have a really good game this weekend as well to come, but also for coming into the World Cup. It would be huge for Ireland, especially, as I said, missing the likes of Erin King in that back row.
Someone I thought deserves a mention as well, just given it was a big start for her, was Siobhan McCarthy. As Lou said, like, we've spoken a lot about Niamh O'Dowd going back into WXV and in the Six Nations as well, with a shoulder injury at the moment, which was tough for her, not being able to get a chance to kind of right some of the wrongs from the England game. But Siobhan McCarthy going in, her first start in international rugby, hasn't actually been playing in the front row that long, would have been a back row for up until second, I think, last row, year, yeah. Or second row, sorry, up until last year or the year before. And scrum steady as a rock. She got involved, made a handful of carries, handful of tackles, got around the pitch, was very, very active on Ireland's breakdown as well, and got through an enormous amount of work. A very good day for her in what would have been a I suppose, a high pressure situation for her.
100% it is, like, and it was great to hear it go well, because it's obviously you've got an able deputy there and someone who can play both sides of the scrum as well, and Christy Haney on the bench. So, like, for Siobhan to get the nod was a huge thing for her. But yeah, as you said, I think the first scrum, you know, was finding her feet a little bit in the first one, but after that she was steady out, and it was great to see her, because I said it is quite nerve-wracking. You've been kind of, you get used, not used to it, but you're kind of in that bench spot so long that you get your minutes and you grab them off the bench, that it's easier to start because you're part of the team run in the starters for the whole week, and then coming to all that kind of aspect of it, you're in it from the get-go and you don't have to kind of be watching it and nerves building off the bench. But yeah, it was great for her, because it can be a tricky one when you've kind of been in there so long and then I've been waiting so long for the start. But yeah, no, it bodes really well. Again, have more strength and depth in the key positions of prop, especially loose head prop, that it's going to be standing to her in that way. And I think Nevo Doubt, hopefully his injury isn't too long term a thing, but likewise she did fantastic in deputising there for her and getting her shout. So she's put her hand up there to make it another interesting selection come next week.
Looking at Saturday then, Scotland away, 2:30 p.m. kickoff. In terms of the table, I have it here, Ireland are third at the moment and pretty much locked into third place. They can't get any higher than third, but if they were to fall down to fourth, it would require them losing heavily against Scotland, and it would require Italy to absolutely hockey Wales as well in the final round. So Italy would need to win with a bonus point against Wales and overturn. Ireland's points difference is 92 better than Italy's at the moment. So you can safely assume Ireland are going to finish third, regardless of what happens this weekend. But I would say this campaign is more about finishing with three wins rather than finishing in third place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. And like, Scotland has been that kind of, not a bogey team as such, but it kind of has been, because as I mentioned earlier, we've always played them in the last round after England, and it's kind of been like a limp to a finish. When we've won, it hasn't even been comprehensive wins, and when we've lost, it's been absolutely chronic, where it's just been a horror match of just not even nice rugby to watch, that has never been kind of showpiece rugby from either side. So I think there's so much history now between us in that, over the last few years, of kind of winning and losing. And obviously they were still the team that knocked us out of the qualification for Barr. And that's still, you know, in everyone's memories every time you go to play them, in terms of getting a one up on them. But obviously Ireland will have fond memories of Belfast last year being the overriding feeling, but Scotland will have the hurt from that too. So they'll be looking to come back. They've had a really mixed campaign. You know, they scraped by Wales in round one. You know, they took a hiding there from the England loss as well. And from the Italy game will be something that kind of sickens them. But they're definitely one that I would kind of, they're definitely better than a Wales. I think their back line is more potent than what Wales have. Pack wise, definitely, I think we've got the upper hand there, but they probably have the likes of their captain, Rachel Malcolm, coming back maybe into the fold there for them, which will buoy them. But at the Hive, they're not going to want to roll over either. And there's like a lot at stake for them in terms of finishing. Everybody wants to finish off the campaign with a good, strong victory as you head into the summer of prep for a World Cup. As we've talked about so many times, you are only as good as your last match. And the feelings that if you lose the last match of the Six Nations, that stinginess tends to stay with you for that bit longer. So Ireland won't want to show that, you know, their whatever two victories have been a flash in the pan. It's about, as you said, finishing off on a high and really cementing that we are third. We're not just above the others, that we're chasing the top two more than just surviving above the others. So it leads for an exciting weekend to finish for sure on Super Saturday.
And like, I know there are World Cup warm-up games, but it is your last opportunity for a few months to plant any sorts of seeds in the mind of Scott Beamont.
That's the thing, because I know, like, I heard a few things on post-match stuff on RT as well, and on kind of interviews and chatter about, like, World Cup, what does this mean for us? But as you said, the girls won't be even anywhere near that headspace, because we've seen already in this campaign the chopping and changing of positions through injury or just through rotation. We saw the nines getting their rotation around, you know, in this last game as well. So from an Ireland perspective, the girls are certainly going to be like, this is my last chance to put my hand up for a jersey this week at training. And in terms of being in the shirt, this is my last time to actually solidify my shout at it before. As you said, those warm-up matches come, but those warm-up matches might have a bit of more wiggle room with them, but you're ultimately looking to put your hand up and, you know, go forward into the summer with a feel-good feeling, but also making sure that you're saying to Scott, pick me, basically, when it comes to it.
Finally, the women's AIL final is on Sunday. Sorry to bring this up. I know you'd only love to be playing it this year. You were beaten by UL Bose in the semi-finals. They're playing Railway on Sunday afternoon, 1:30 p.m. at the Aviva Stadium. Repeat of last year's final, which Bowes won 48-38 in an absolute madcap game. How is this shaping up? So this year, they finished the top two. Railway win 18 out of 18. UL Bowes win 16 out of 18. Railway won both games when they played 19-18 and 17-10. So not much between them on paper. You've obviously played both over the course of the season.
Two contrasting sides, very much so. UL Bowes, look, they beat us there last Saturday or Saturday 2 weeks ago. And, you know, we're deserved winners. We came out of the blocks really fast for BlackRock and we were off to a good start and trying to play our game plan. But ultimately, you come up against the UL Bowes side who are very used to playing with each other. A lot of them play with each other in Munster as well. They kind of invest the same kind of style of play, that kind of front ball rugby, big carries, and they've got pacey backs outside where they want to get the ball to the likes of Chisholm Mugweru and Clara Barrett and a few others, to name a few, that they have pace out wide. So they're well used tactically to playing each other. They kind of have their plan A and that works for them. And fair play, they do it really well. And it's shown that in those 16 matches that they've won, including the semi-final against us, that they can execute that really well. And they're devil in the detail of the key bits of play that they need to do to turn the screw. I think Railway, on the other hand, like to play a good fastball. Not a fan of much set piece, where they've got good strength in the scrum and even the height of Aoife McDermott in the line-out, but they tend to want to play ball. They want to play ball quickly and they want to stretch it. They want to use the pace that they have and the ballers that they have to play it almost like a sevens game at time, where they keep that ball moving. They love a quick tap penalty. So it is a very much two contrasting sides. I think last year, as you mentioned, it was a bananas game in the Aviva, where I think in the end, that ultimately, like, UL Bowes showed that they stuck to their system and they stuck to their patterns, and Railway kind of fell away from what was working for them and ultimately were left chasing a game that got out of their reach. So it's going to make for a really interesting thing. I think two really contrasting styles of play that they have, but ultimately something's going to have to give to see who can kind of outmuscle each other when it comes to it. So yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting game, a close game, so we'll see. It'll be interesting.
And I know Bowes won last year, obviously, when they met in the Aviva, but how does the setting, the Aviva, just the pitch alone factor into it? Because it's obviously a very, very different pitch to the majority of games that we played over the course of the season. And I've seen it in the men's finals as well over the last couple of years, where because of the conditions and the type of pitch that it is, a lovely, fast, like short-cut grass, it's ideal for running fast rugby, and it's led to some fairly open games across the men's finals and the women's final last year.
Yeah, and it does, like, I think it's the showpiece of it as well. I think obviously we were dying to be there ourselves from a BlackRock point of view, because it's what you pinpoint at the start of the season, that it's great now for the women's game as well to be able to say that, look, we have an opportunity here to get to play rugby in the Aviva on AIL Finals Day is what you want. I think for the two teams, the thing is they were both there last year. The style of play, they both have the ability to play that wide rugby. They've both got good kicking games. Railway probably more of a running game than a kicking game. So defensively, it's going to be interesting to see how they match up against each other and whether they just double down on playing their own game, or tactically, whether they have something up their sleeve to counteract what the opposition are doing. But yeah, that fast, like, it's where you want to be playing your rugby. Like, every rugby player in Ireland will want to play rugby on a Sunday in the Aviva. Like, so it's the stuff of dreams. So to be able to do that, it's just going to be an interesting tussle. Definitely one to watch this weekend in terms of who'll come out on top.
Don't think you're getting away without me forcing you into a prediction. Which group of friends and former teammates are you going to insult here?
Who do I least like to be able to say that? It's hard to know, like, whether a UL Bowes winning will make us feel better or worse in terms of us not being there. I think my head is saying, based on how Railway have played and the players they've kind of got back into the fold for them this year and the experience they have dotted throughout their kind of spine of their team, I think ultimately their pace game might be able to have the upper hand over Bowes on the day. But we saw that last year, that they started off that way and then kind of fell away from that. So I think the benefit of last year and what they didn't achieve last year would probably stand to them, and the kind of the bittersweet feeling that they were left with, they won't be wanting to feel that again. So I'm going to say Railway, as much as it sickens me to say it either on either front.
Are you going to head along, or are you the kind that wouldn't be able to bear just
I don't know. I don't know if I'll be able to bear going to it, but I'll try. I'll be supporting it anyway in terms of women's sport in Ireland, but I definitely won't be supporting either team.
Yeah, 1:30 kickoff at the Aviva on Sunday afternoon, and the men's final in Clontarf against Lansdowne follows at 4:00. Loads of rugby on RTE over the next few days. Italy and Wales, and England versus France, both in the Women's Six Nations on Saturday on RTE Player. There's a live blog as well of Ireland against Scotland from 2:30 p.m. on rte.ie/sport. And there's commentary on Saturday Sport on RT Radio 1. And then in the URC, a doubleheader Saturday afternoon, Scarlets against Leinster and Ulster versus Sharks from 4:45 p.m. That's on RT2 and RT Player as well. Hannah, brilliant having you on again as always. Enjoy the match on Saturday and enjoy the match on Sunday if you have the bandwidth to be able to do that.
Yeah, cheers, Neil. Thanks a million. We'll do.